From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, U.S. foreign policy, from Harry Truman to the present day.
It is agonizing for America to lose our young men and women. It is costly and politically difficult to continue this conflict.
We'll talk to the author of a new book who says foreign policy in the U.S. is caught between presidents who want to do more and those who want to do less.
Nixon's chief of staff said to Kissinger that the president really did want to go to China in his first term. Kissinger's response was, fat chance.
That's Stephen Sestanovich talking about his new book, Maximalist, America in the World from Truman to Obama. Ahead on this special edition of FSN Reports, after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has said Russia could ease tensions with Ukraine by moving its troops away from the country's eastern border. Mr. Obama warned that Moscow could have additional plans in the region, but urged his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin to move back the soldiers and start talks with the new government in Kiev. Washington correspondent Lorna Shattuck reports.
In an interview recorded during his trip to Italy on Thursday, President Obama urged the Kremlin not to escalate the situation in Ukraine any further. It's believed Russia has now massed several thousand troops close to Ukraine's eastern frontier. The U.S. president said their presence could be an effort to intimidate Ukraine, or they could be there because, as he put it, Moscow has additional plans. He went on to warn that Vladimir Putin is misreading the West, but didn't specify what the U.S. would do if Russia did push further into Ukraine.
Meanwhile, President Putin says the recent events in Crimea have demonstrated a high level of readiness of the Russian armed forces. In a televised ceremony, the Russian president thanked the commanders and servicemen of the Black Sea Fleet and other units deployed in Crimea for their restraint and personal courage, acknowledging for the first time that the troops in Crimea were Russian. Previously, Vladimir Putin described them as local self-defense units. Five planes have spotted objects in the new area of the Indian Ocean being searched for the missing Malaysian Airlines jet. But the Australian Maritime Safety Authority says the sightings need to be confirmed by ship. Rescue efforts continue in the U.S. state of Washington nearly a week after a massive mudslide obliterated the small town of Oso, north of Seattle. The death toll continues to rise as officials recover bodies, including that of a four-month-old girl. U.S. President Barack Obama made a brief visit to Saudi Arabia on Friday in a bid to reassure King Abdullah that Washington has not abandoned his nation. Relations between the U.S. and Saudi have deteriorated in recent months amid fears over nuclear negotiations with Iran and America's policy on Syria. Nina Maria Potts reports from Washington.
An evening in the Saudi King's Palace, President Obama's trip to the Royal Desert Camp outside Riyadh for a meeting and dinner meant as reassurance that his administration has not neglected the kingdom. But Saudi's governing royal family, having enjoyed a decades-long alliance with the United States, is anxious and angry over President Obama's nuclear talks with Iran, a powerful threat to Saudi Arabia's dominance in the region. White House officials say the main concerns are Iran and its role in Syria, where Saudi Arabia wants the Assad regime unseated.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Ecuador has requested the U.S. extradite two Ecuadorian brothers accused of fraud and money laundering back to their home country, where they face 8 years of jail time. But the U.S. government denied Ecuador's request. It's now leading its own investigation into whether hundreds of thousands of dollars the fugitives donated to American political campaigns was in fact stolen money. Andrea Arenas reports.
The fugitive siblings have been living in Miami since 2001 and are being accused by the Ecuadorian government of embezzling millions of dollars from Filambanco, a bank they owned and that went bankrupt. Now the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is also investigating Roberto and William Isaias for possible money laundering. The investigation focuses on whether dubious money was transferred to American banks and if it continues to circulate. So far, the Isaías brothers have not commented on the money laundering allegations. The brothers were among the wealthiest people in Ecuador. They had interests in sugar, media, and banking, among others.
The first gay marriages are taking place in England and Wales at the stroke of midnight on Friday. Gay couples have been able to enter into civil partnerships since 2005, but campaigners for equal rights said the distinction between a partnership and a marriage made them feel like second-class citizens. The government legalized same-sex marriage in July. It was supported by Prime Minister David Cameron and opposition parties, but many of Mr. Cameron's conservative MPs opposed it on what they said were religious grounds. Under the terms of the law, religious organizations will have to opt in to offer the weddings. Gay rights activist Peter Tatchell says the change in the law is a major milestone.
We've finally ended the ban on same-sex marriage. We now accept in this country that gay people are entitled to equal rights, including equal validation of their love and commitment.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I do have an unyielding belief that all people yearn for certain things. The ability to speak your mind and have a say in how you are governed. Confidence in the rule of law and the equal administration of justice. These are not just American ideas, they are human rights. And that is why we will support them everywhere.
President Barack Obama speaking in Cairo, Egypt, on June the 4th, 2009, the first major foreign policy speech of his presidency. The White House called it a new beginning to underscore the difference between the president's worldview and that of his predecessor, George W. Bush. On this special edition of the program, we're going to put U.S. foreign policy under the microscope. Syria, Iran, Ukraine, they've all led to a challenging time for the president and his vision. But Barack Obama is by no means the first occupant of the Oval Office to find foreign policy both an opportunity and sometimes a curse. Joining me today, a man who has worked in the front lines of U.S. foreign policy and now written a terrific book about those front lines, Stephen Sestanovich, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, a professor at Columbia University, and from 1997 to 2001, U.S. ambassador at large to the former Soviet Union. His new book is called Maximalist: America in the World from Truman to Obama, and it's published by Knopf. Steve Sestanovich, welcome to the program. What is a maximalist?
Well, American foreign policymakers operate in two modes. They are maximalists or they're retrenchers. Maximalists tend to be responding to what they see as a problem of undercommitment in past policy. So they tend to say the United States has to do more, has to think bigger. Pedal to the metal is their slogan. That tends to be an ambitious policy, one involving a commitment of larger resources, vaster aims, determination to solve problems quickly. Maximalist presidents tend to think the American public has a short attention span. It tends to involve a commitment to doing things on our own because maximalist presidents don't trust allies any more than anyone else. And those are the key elements of maximalism. It tends, by the way, to lead to overdoing it.
And just to be clear from the outset, you're not saying that one of these approaches is good and one is bad. You're laying out a way of essentially viewing American foreign policy through a prism that goes beyond party and ideology.
Absolutely. The United States has a kind of idealized view of its foreign policy, a picture of continuity, bipartisanship. In reality, American policy has fluctuated between these two modes, maximalism and retrenchment. Retrenchment is the pullback that follows the excesses of maximalism.
So let's look at a few examples. And obviously, later in the interview, I want to bring this to the present day. But you start with Truman,
yeah.
The creation of the Truman Doctrine, the launch of the Marshall Plan, essentially as the creation of the modern day, as you identify it, maximalist concept?
Well, the Truman administration had a mini retrenchment after World War II, a pause, a pullback, a kind of downsizing, a hope that American policy in the world could be less ambitious, involve less responsibility for what happened everywhere. Within about 2 years, it became clear that that was not a viable approach. And beginning in 1947, there was a much more expansive concept of what the United States had to do.
So it was, from their perspective, not just a moral imperative, it was a political must.
Absolutely. There was a conviction that without this active role of the United States, what Acheson called the added energy of America, that there would be chaos. The United States was seen to play an indispensable role, to use a phrase of President Bill Clinton.
I want to come back to that indispensable nation a bit later on. Let's move on to John F. Kennedy, and let me quote from the book. You write that with no foreign policy experience, he came to Washington declaring that it was better to have a wrong decision made than no decision at all. The key to understanding John F. Kennedy's maximalism, you write, is to see that it was designed from the beginning with an escape hatch. And that is intriguing because it's the first sort of indication historically, that maximalism doesn't have to be the untrammeled pedal fully to the metal approach.
Right. Maximalists are generally nervous about overcommitment, about excessive risk, and they try to find ways of compensating, of limiting the dangers and costs of American policy. And President Kennedy was a great example of that. He was by instinct a maximalist. He was wary of the downsides. My view is that maximalists tend to have an awareness of the risks of maximalism, but to find it difficult to change course, just as retrenchers do. American presidents, this is one important theme of the book, generally find it very difficult to change the policy that they set out on.
And in the case of John F. Kennedy, there was some short-termism about his approach. It wasn't always rooted in a long historical vision.
Many of his advisors felt he was too short-term in the way he approached problems. Some of them said, you know, he would interrupt a meeting asking, look, let's not think about the next 5 years. What do we do tomorrow? That was the Kennedy concept of vigor and decisiveness.
So let's move on to Nixon, who famously in 1970 says, America cannot and will not conceive all the plans, design all the programs, execute all the decisions, and undertake all the defense of the free nations of the world. We will help where it makes a real difference and is considered in our interest. How seismic a shift in foreign policy was that, moving from one presidency to the next?
Well, Nixon came to office as the Vietnam War was seen by the American public and by American policymakers as a disaster from which the United States had to extricate itself. Nixon was, interestingly, a kind of reverse of Kennedy. He was a retrencher. He had no choice but to be a retrencher in office. But he was very mindful of the problems that retrenchment created. And he was aware that you had to fight against those the downside by being more activist, by trying to exercise leadership. But he, too, found it difficult to be more than a retrencher. His momentum, the momentum of his policy, carried him toward a downsized policy.
A downsized policy and yet a presidency that opened up the dialogue and the relationship with China, which, if one looked at it in sort of stark relief terms, that's a pretty maximalist thing to do, albeit within a presidency that in other areas of foreign policy was focused on doing less.
That's right. For Nixon, he said of the opening to China, he said, Jesus, this is a hell of a move. He was very thrilled by the excitement that he thought this opening would create. And it did have a kind of geopolitical significance that helped to restabilize American policy after the impact of Vietnam. But in many other ways, the policy of this period, of the 70s, was a policy of retrenchment, of downsized budgets, of trying to push responsibility onto allies, engaging with adversaries in hopes that tensions would be reduced so that the United States didn't have to do as much.
And also with the Nixon presidency, you write about the tension that existed at times with his advisors, particularly with Kissinger on this issue of opening up to China, which is fascinating given the extent to which we now, I think, historically associate those two men marching lockstep on that issue.
Henry Kissinger was somewhat wary of Nixon's ideas about an opening to China. He called them a flight of fancy. When Nixon's chief of staff said to Kissinger that the president really did want to go to China in his first term, Kissinger's response was, fat chance.
Okay, Ronald Reagan, historically thought of as the man who broke communism, in the minds of his admirers, I suspect, thought of as the president who took maximalism to the max. But I wonder if you think he did. I mean, there are tensions that you relay in the book in his relationship with, for example, General Alexander Haig, who was really pushing him at the beginning of his presidency to do even more.
Reagan was a maximalist like Kennedy, wary of overcommitment. He was operating within a political context where the shadow of Vietnam was very important. But broadly speaking, Reagan managed to succeed in pushing a kind of maximalist agenda while staying out of war. He is the maximalist in this story who doesn't get himself embroiled in a big war. And that turns out to be crucial to his success because he doesn't have to be able to produce a short-term successful military results, justify the costs of a losing operation. Instead, his maximalism involves maximal pressure on the Soviet Union in this interesting duel that he has with Mikhail Gorbachev. One in which he gives Gorbachev almost nothing that Gorbachev asks for, but does it with such a smile and an engaging insistence on American benevolent intentions that he never has to back down, retreat from maximalism.
You don't spend much of the book discussing Iran-Contra. And I wondered why, because critics of Reagan would assert that that was not just maximalism, but maximalism gone criminally extreme.
It was an example of the poor management that characterized the Reagan administration, the occasional, sometimes more than occasional, disorder in policymaking. The mutual suspicions of senior officials, it almost brought down the Reagan presidency. What's interesting about it is that it, for many people, seemed to argue for a different kind of policy. Go easy on the Soviets, try to back off, look reasonable, try to reduce tensions. Reagan did that, but without yielding the substance of his positions. The revival of the Reagan presidency after Iran-Contra is actually a kind of miraculous story of political life after a near-death experience.
Mm. But was there a lesson in that in terms of the direction that he was taking in foreign policy? Did it then impact the subsequent policy that he put into practice?
Well, to my mind, the late Reagan administration is a picture both of Reagan's extraordinary defects and extraordinary strengths. And he was lucky to have on the other side of the negotiating table in Gorbachev somebody who was very susceptible to the strengths, who was determined really to find a way out of the Cold War given the intransigent positions that the United States had taken.
So you got us to the George H.W. Bush administration, and there's a quote in the book from General Brent Scowcroft, who expresses frustration about the initial response of the then Bush administration to the 1990 Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. And if the quote is intriguing to me because it could almost entirely be applied to the current day and to the issues that have bedeviled the Obama administration dealing with Russia on the issue of Crimea and Ukraine. Brent Scowcroft emerges from a meeting appalled, and you write, what he had heard suggested resignation to the invasion and even adaptation to a fait accompli, letting a dictator swallow up a friendly state in a vital region, he announced at a subsequent meeting, should not be a policy option. And he engages in this process of spine-stiffening George H.W. Bush. But what's so fascinating about that is you can literally apply that to the conversation that's taking place at the White House right now over Russia, Ukraine, and Crimea.
George Kennan had a great phrase for how American policymakers respond and the American policy establishment responds in time of crisis. He says it's like a stone thrown into a beehive. People buzz around with all kinds of ideas about what should be the appropriate policy in this seemingly new era. They have no consensus that forms until some leadership is exercised. Scowcroft was expressing that kind of frustration because in the immediate impact of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, there wasn't any agreement among American policymakers as to what ought to be done. And it took a certain amount of time to figure out what the right choices were. For the Obama administration, they've faced a number of moments where there's been this same stone in the beehive anxiety about what to do in the past couple of years about Syria, and particularly last summer with the president's famous red line about chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. And now with Ukraine, you see the Washington policy establishment buzzing with all kinds of proposals, but so far, no real consensus emerging as to what should be done. Is this the moment for a new activism, or is it just one more difficulty to which the United States will adjust in its period of retrenchment?
Let me go back to that Cairo speech, which in many ways was where the Obama foreign policy began. And in many ways, it's a classic definition of retrenchment, as you write about it. Let's just take a listen to what Barack Obama had to say.
We do not want to keep our troops in Afghanistan. We seek no military bases there. It is agonizing for America to lose our young men and women. It is costly and politically difficult to continue this conflict. We would gladly bring every single one of our troops home if we could be confident that there were not violent extremists in Afghanistan and now Pakistan determined to kill as many Americans as they possibly can.
It's almost a classic definition of his desire to pull back and downscale in foreign policy terms, but it's left him open to enormous amounts of criticism over both Crimea this year, Syria last year, the Washington Post saying recently in an editorial that he's pursuing a fantasy foreign policy.
Well, I think from the beginning, President Obama has been convinced that this was a time to pull back from over-engagement in the world. And the public and most of the political elite really agreed with him. When he came to office, 79% of both Democrats and Republicans said the United States should pay less attention to the world beyond our shores. The president has tried to figure out a way of reducing costs and commitments without seeming to sacrifice crucial American interests. He has, to my mind, been a relatively strong leader over a policy of caution and some would even say weakness, certainly downsizing. This is the difficulty that retrenchers face. They have to decide how far is down. When do you stop pulling back? When do you see that the status quo has turned against the United States? It's not an unfamiliar predicament for retrenchment. In the 1950s, people said Eisenhower had gone too far, not standing up to or competing with the Soviet Union. In the 1970s, people said the same thing about détente. In the 1990s, people said the same thing about the inability to cope with ethnic violence in the Balkans, for example. So for the president, this is maybe a more familiar problem than he realizes. The difficult moment for retrenchment comes after you've put aside the wars that you were brought in to clean up, Iraq, Afghanistan. Now the president is faced with the challenge of defining a new foreign policy separate from Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's turning out to be pretty hard to do.
But this is a president who has characterized his own foreign policy as restrained and, I think, thoughtful. While that thoughtful process is taking place in Washington, is he not communicating to Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and other leaders on the world stage that there is now a vacuum in global leadership terms into which they can leap?
There is certainly a question in the minds of all of the governments that you mention and others around the world as to the nature of American engagement going forward. But I think they have to be a bit confused about it, partly because American policy is itself somewhat ambivalent about the nature of our interests and of our future commitment.
Is there a way of escaping the yo-yo that you lay out historically between maximalists and retrenchers? Indeed, is it even desirable to escape it? Or at the end of the day, do you think that that yo-yo is actually quite good for the country?
Well, it's odd to say this, but I become a kind of believer in discontinuity, and here's why. It's very tempting to think you can have a steady state policy that's sustainable over a long period of time. But my conclusion from the research that I did in telling the stories from these presidents, and I try to make it as vivid as possible because otherwise it's not convincing, is that they just can't find a way of avoiding excess. The maximalists overdo it. The retrenchers underdo it. It would be great to have policies that avoid the excesses of both sides, but I don't see a lot of examples of policymakers who've been able to do that.
There's a lot in this book for anybody who's interested in foreign policy. There's a lot in this book for anybody who doesn't think they are interested in foreign policy. But there's also something tantalizing at the end about elections. It's traditionally said foreign policy has no impact on a presidential election. Doesn't matter. People vote pocketbook issues. You write in the epilogue of the book, since World War II, only one president who initiated a process of retrenchment has failed to win a second term. Are you suggesting that, in fact, an approach to foreign policy can be a predicator for electoral success?
Oh, absolutely. All retrenchers come in with a kind of national consensus that the American role in the world has been too great, too costly, too dangerous, and that there's some specific war that needs to be cleaned up. And they do that, and they win the gratitude of the American people. Eisenhower, Nixon, Obama were decisively reelected. This is a vote of confidence that the American people routinely give to our presidents who mop up the disasters that our maximalist presidents get us into. But the American people then generally decide they aren't quite so comfortable with the policy of retrenchment going forward into the future. That retrenchment policy becomes more controversial, and it usually leads to an electoral choice of someone with more ambitious aims.
We will see what comes down the pike. Steve Sestanovich, it's a fantastic book. It's called Maximalist, America in the World from Truman to Obama. It is published by Knopf. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about it today.
Thanks, Simon.
And that's our special edition of FSN Reports. On Monday, we'll be back with our more regular diet of news from around the world. I'm Simon Marks. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.